welcome to the first ever Big Dog Books podcast. So this is the first of what will hopefully be a series of podcasts talking about different things that we do here at Big Dog Books. And today we're going to be talking about GMing, tabletop roleplay games, and what it's like running sessions for people. There's a bunch of people here with me today. I'm Stuart Kane, manager of Big Dog Books, and I'll pass you over to...
I'm Tom Bubb, GM and player of tabletop games.
I'm Louise Hunter, and I work at Big Dogs, and I also GM and play tabletop games.
I'm Ewan Monaghan. I'm a GM and also a human being.
Debatable.
Sometimes.
So one of the things that I wanted us to talk about today is what it's like running roleplay games, because lots of people want to come and play them. But one of the hardest things I think folk find is the idea of running them yourself. And I wanted to talk about how to get started in that. So because everyone around here has ran a lot of different games. And yeah, I just thought that would be a sort of interesting thing to get a point across to people, that it's not that difficult a thing to do and is really good fun in itself. So the big kind of famous and common one these days, probably because of Critical Role, is D&D, and everyone's heard of Dungeons & Dragons and everybody wants to play that. But we all play, there's a variety of different games out there and we all play different ones. So I was wondering if you guys would all tell me about a game that you have GM'd and kind of what that game is.
Cool. Well, the one I'd say I probably ran for the longest was Pathfinder, which started life as an offshoot for Dungeons & Dragons. People thought the rules for D&D were getting a bit vague, so a group of people decided, let's make a slightly chunkier system. And I was quite interested in giving it a go, because I'd only played 4th edition of Dungeons & Dragons before, which was quite light on a lot of the role-playing aspects. And yeah, I opted to take over as the GM for that group because I was at university, our current games master was getting a bit too busy. And I just thought I'd give it a bash. And it's, as Stuart was saying, it's not as complicated as it first seems. It takes a bit of reading, really.
I've actually only done D&D in a shop setting so far, but I was really, really nervous when we were about to start it up because I am also dyslexic, so I was really phobic of all like the reading I thought there would be. But to be honest with you, as long as that you're going off of a bit of a storyline and you've got a few bullet points, you can pull a story together really quickly. So whatever anybody's afraid, if they see the massive textbooks and think, I need to have everything memorized, you can waffle quite a bit and it's good fun.
I ran Shadowrun quite recently. And to be honest, I did not learn most of the rules for that. I winged almost everything. But it was more important to me that everybody enjoyed their time with it rather than having to dig through a rule book to find how far it takes to throw how far you can throw a grenade underwater when you're being chased by a shark.
A very important rule.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like it's what the entire game was based about.
But that name was a bit too long.
I think that's a really good point you've made there, Ewan, is that the idea that you somehow need to memorise the entire rule book, and Louise and Tommy both said it as well about the reading, because when you look at an RPG core rule book, it's usually this huge tome, hundreds of pages long, and it looks terrifying. But then when you get down to it, most games have a few simple mechanics and a bunch of rules which are basically optional, and you as the GM are the god of your games. You get to decide how much of them you're going to do. So, like, the game that I most commonly GM is Call of Cthulhu, which has three different ways of playing. So you can play it as this really pulp action game, the kind of very slow-burn horror investigatory game, or you can play it as a very, very intense, nightmarish, twisted, spooky game. And they all have different ways of manipulating the mechanics, but you can just kind of pick the one that you want to do and go with it. And it's more about you being able to make the game, as you said, fun for your players rather than I must follow these rules exactly.
That's exactly the thing. When I ran Pathfinder, as I said, it's a very very chunky system. And what that usually means, it's very numbers heavy. And if you're sat down at a table trying to tell a story, nothing breaks your immersion quicker than having to go, okay, cool. So you've walked into the tavern and you want to talk to the barmaid about events going on. Now, give me half an hour whilst I flick through three different books, trying to find a table for rumours, how exactly she might respond to somebody of your race or how you're behaving. Whereas, yeah, you can just kind of wing it and just go, well, I know where they are and what's going on. Yeah, sure. It's much quicker oftentimes to go, yeah, sure. And that keeps you in the game, keeps you immersed, and keeps everybody having fun.
It's that sort of really cool thing, isn't it? It's like, if it works in the setting of your game, why stop your player doing it?
Yeah. Completely, yeah. It's the whole thing with the hobby is it is interactive storytelling. And as an example, Lord of the Rings, you know, with Legolas sliding down the stairs on a shield, shooting orcs, that's cool. Mm-hmm. It's a bit silly, but it's cool. And being able to sort of do things like that in a game, nice and easy, keeps it all alive, definitely.
I mean, I've had players who've decided to jump out of planes to punch dragons. I've had people accidentally make toasters into, like, half cat, half toaster. And it's all just kind of been like, let's, like, riff on that for a while until I, like, remember what's next or, like, what the kind of next scene should be.
The GM waffle of, that's really good. You guys figure out what you're going to do next while I figure out where in the story we've wandered off to.
But that's exactly it. I read a post the other day, which is just quite a short one. It was just saying, the thing I love most about Dungeons & Dragons is, you know, you have an hour of epic, mind-blowing combat, and then an hour of selecting which horse you're going to ride to the next city. And that's wonderful as a GM, because you can then almost push the responsibility a little bit. If you're a little stuck and you're sort of, I don't know where we're going next, let your players tell the story for a bit. They want to. They've got ideas and they want to play together. And you can definitely use that as a get-rid-jail-free card to just be sort of, okay, cool, names, places, weather, blah, and yeah.
The amount of times that you'll say something and they'll get fixated on the thing that is not plot and they go off on a tangent and you're like, that's fine, you can go there, but you need to come back eventually.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing, is where you've got, you know, especially if you've got a book adventure, if it's not one you've written up yourself, if you're using like a D&D supplement or something and you've got this plot line and your players pick up one word and disappear down a tangent and you're like, right, okay, I now have to invent, I can either tramline the game back to where I need it to be, and there your players feel like they're missing out on something.
It doesn't feel natural either, does it? It's kind of, you, it eliminates the free choice aspect, mm-hmm. kind of going, this is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I find really helpful for that is, again, back to Call of Cthulhu, because Louise, you play in my Cthulhu group, is I've got the little decks of the random events. So like when last week when we were playing and you're on that boat and folk were like, who's on the boat with us? We're on a passenger ferry. I was like, don't know, I'll just draw the first 10 cards off of the NPC deck and these are now people. And then it sparked off stories on its own. So it's like, I hadn't done any planning, I didn't need to, but it was, how do your characters interact with this random person? Oh, that took up 20 minutes of the adventure. You know, it keeps everything feeling organic.
Well, it's generally a good rule of thumb. Like whenever I've ran a game, I've had at the back of my workbook just a full page of names. So if, again, to draw back to the tavern thing, you go in and there's a half-orc barmaid behind the bar. People go, oh, what's she called? You can just, Gruntilda. You know, you've got a thing there, but then people will pick up on that and you can spend the next 20 minutes doing the old GM waffle, which is great.
The most recent D&D adventure, Waterdeep Heist, had an entire like section just based on who's in the bar. Like, there's 100 different people you can meet there. So it's just, oh, I want to go up to somebody, just roll a D100. And there's your, like, that's who I'm speaking to now.
Yeah, just that kind of random element. I think that's because I've been playing roleplay games a long time. And I think if you go back maybe 20 years or more, everything was so, when you got the games were so prescribed. Someone had written this story and you were acting out the characters in this story and you had no choice. Whereas your kind of modern games, they require from the GM less absolute knowledge of the world. It's just enough to get by, and it's really about sparking those stories, because it's the stories that are the kind of more important parts than the rolling of the dice, as it were.
Well, in my D&D group, I've got six guys I play with that I run it with, and each one of them has created their own backstory. And as we're going through the current storyline, we're pulling up little bits that I can see tying into their storyline. And I'll hint towards it. I'll point out that there's a thing there. And they'll be like, does that connect with this thing? That's my entire backstory that I've been planning out for months. And I'm like, no, not really. But we'll make it now. We can now tie it together. And it gets them really excited. And it makes them interact a lot more. And then they get really invested.
No, I would always push players to provide a backstory. And it doesn't need to be a 14-page epic complete with songs and dance numbers. But just enough so that as a games master and them as a player know who they are, where they've come from, and why they do what they do. Because then, if you get stuck as a GM, you can lean across and look at this. So in the game that I'm playing at the moment, Deadlands, which is Wild West, but things have gone very strange. There's magic and demons and all that good stuff. Having backstory. So if we get stuck and, you know, we don't know exactly where we're progressing or a player's missing for a session, the GM of that game can turn around and go, right, cool, you had this guy in your backstory who was a bad guy. Guess who's rolled into town today? And you've, boom, got a session right there. And it makes everybody feel like they're doing their bit.
There's the game... What's it called? The black box one you and I played.
Oh, Summertime.
Invisible Sun.
Invisible Sun.
Summertime. And I'm rolling the dice. It takes that idea of the player backstory really to the ultimate degree, doesn't it? Because Invisible Sun has no plot. What happens is you make up a set of characters, and part of the character generation, you have a deep, why is your character this person? You go through the whole backstory bit. And as a result, the game is then about the characters acting out, following up on their own backstories. That has no actual content, like driving forces a game and a story that way. It's really all just off the characters, and it makes it such a really different way to play the game. Because I think there's lots of different styles of games. I think we've mentioned a few here, D&D, Cthulhu and things like that. And you get your very, you know, like I prefer the games that are not combat games. It's just my style. So D&D... yeah, it's a great game, but it's mostly just dungeon clacks. But I like Call of Cthulhu, where it's more like puzzle solving, or Invisible Sun, where it's all about esoteric, or something like Feng Shui, where it's just how silly can you describe, like how over the top can you describe what you're doing rather than dice roll things. But what kind of games do you guys like to play?
So my favourite one to run so far has definitely been Genesis, and that sits in the same sort of sphere. It's less about combat, it's more about telling a story. You don't even use dice with numbers on them. You've got dice with little symbols, and you basically roll a handful of dice, and the bad ones mean you didn't win, the good ones mean you did win, and it's basically that simple. And it just gets a lot of mechanical stuff out of the way and just gives room for storytelling, and you're doing it all together, and you know, there's not this animosity where one person is the bad guy. Oftentimes people think that the Games Master is the bad guy because they play the orcs and the goblins, but they also play the weather and the paths and the dustbin on the corner. They're not a bad guy. They're the computer, as it were. They're the machine, and they can be included in it all. But that's the kind of thing I prefer to go for. What about yourself, Louise?
I like... Cthulhu is my favourite thing to play because I like horror and I love things being spooky and creepy. And I love, like... there's so many things that so far in the game that we've been playing where we've really fought things through in a D&D manner, and oh my gosh, has it gone wrong? Because it was, I came straight from playing D&D to do Calling Cthulhu, and one of the first things we tried to do was blow up a building because we thought that would get rid of the big bad, and might have killed a lot of people and caused much damage.
I'm sure you're still wanted in New York for that.
Oh, yeah. I so am.
Yeah, your party aren't allowed back to that part of New York because you leveled several buildings.
Yeah.
And there was, in fact, this, I sort of sub-GM'd on a session playing a bunch of monsters. Uh-huh. And with the D&D mentality, it's, spooky monster, kill it. Whereas Cthulhu likes to ground itself a bit more in, you're just a bunch of dudes. This horrible cosmic dog creature from the depths of hell is going to kill you. And it did. And I had a lot of fun.
Exactly, because like in that session that you ran where you're the bad guys, my main job was to pull people out of the building, and in D&D you don't have to worry about people being left behind because they're going to be fine, you can resurrect them. But in Cthulhu, if I've had a stab wound once and I took over half of my damage in one go, and if I had got hit again I would just be dead. So it's really nice having something that makes you more cautious in a game. It makes you really plan things out instead of just running into things and be like, haha, shield and weapon. Smash, smash, smash.
Yeah, it lends more to the, like, the creeping uneasiness of Cthulhu. If you can just run into a situation and shoot it till it goes away, it's not going to be scary. Whereas if you know that you're probably going to have to run and not look back and hope for the best, that makes it terrifying.
So that way, the game mechanics really change how you play. Well, of course they change how you play the game, but they change the whole feel of it as well, because I think you hit on the right point there. D&D, you have healing potions, you have healing magic, you have a million ways to get your hit points back. Even death isn't the end, because you can just pay to be resurrected. But if you play... if you play Call of Cthulhu, or if you play like Feng Shui or something, one of these
Deadlands
other ones
as well. Deadlands, that's very easy to die in.
You die, and it's, you know, it's the difference between having 6 hit points in Call of Cthulhu is pretty big, whereas having 400 in D&D is like, oh well, that's fine, that's normal.
It's only 400. It's there's something about the terror of knowing if I mess up this one fairly innocuous dice roll, this person's gone. they're away. I'm never seeing that character again, and I love it.
Although D&D did have the Tomb of Annihilation adventure, was like, if your hit points reach zero, make a new character.
Yeah, because that was the one they tried. They, from a storyline point of view, they cut off resurrection, didn't they? So it was like everyone's one and done.
Yeah. Then they offered the like hard mode, which was it's much easier for you to die, but you'll get more experience for it. Mm-hmm. And that was done on, like, every player could opt into it if they wanted. But, like, if you were in a party with, like, well, somebody who's brand new to the game, they could be like, oh, I'll just be a regular thing. Don't kill me, please.
Because I think D&D, from its story modules, is changing. You can really see the difference these days from the older ones, which, again, were just here is a dungeon, make your way through it and find a treasure at the end, to now... even it's starting to adopt a far more free-range approach. Like, Tomb of Annihilation was mostly just a big map of random events. It was really interesting that they'd gone from the one the year before that, the Storm Giants one, that was just endlessly boring adventures of trek a dungeon, kill a giant, trek a dungeon, kill a giant, to Tomb of Annihilation, which was just a great big map of run around. It was like playing Skyrim or something. It was just like run around and do some stuff. It was really cool.
Well, I think it's changed quite a lot again with the Waterdeep heist, as like, I don't feel like that, like, it's a good way to get into Dungeons and Dragons, but I don't feel like it's a good adventure in itself. Just because it's chapter one, you're there to meet somebody, and that's fine, it all goes as planned. Then it's chapter two, this person's coming up to you again, chapter three, and it's very, everything seems like we're meeting this one person who seems to have all the answers to all the things, and we conveniently run into stuff because of him. Mm-hmm. Whereas, at least with Tomb of Annihilation, it's you can absolutely go in the wrong direction for 6 weeks like of actual time before finding out, oh, we were meant to talk to somebody back home. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're saying that the kind of streamlines, you know, you go here and you're... adventures are sparked off by this sort of one person. And there's new games come out at the market all the time for roleplay games, and one of the ones that's just come out that's really surprised me is it's called Wrath and Glory, and it's the new Warhammer 40k roleplay game. And I knew it was coming out, and I thought it would be very much bang bang shooty. It'll be space D&D, and it'll be quite simple because it's trying to tie into a cross-market thing. And I'm really surprised that it's got this really clever set of rules, because it's not aimed at existing role players, it's aimed at new people, and it's aimed at getting people into the hobby. So the rule system is really quite simple for how you do all the interactions, but the way it sets up its world is very clever. So you're not running into the same NPC every 5 minutes, it's just feeding out bits of the exposition and just saying, right, here is your next bit of plot. You know, like when you build your little adventure, it comes out with things like, oh, you're all a group of orcs and you're trying to achieve this one big goal over so many weeks, and you set all that out before you start the game. So it gives you a kind of playpen to run around in, but at the same time it's like you've got loads of freedom within it, but it's got a nice structure for how you start a game. It's really good that way.
We'd love to give that a go sometime. Actually, it does sound really fun. Because I like something that just works easily mechanically. It's just being able to sit down and play a game and have a lot of fun with it. You know, going back to the whole having to comb through a rule book to figure out how far away does the shark need to be before you can hit it with that frag grenade. You know, it's just being able to jump in is fantastic.
I played the older Warhammer role-playing games. So there's ones by FFG, who have done stuff like Deathwatch, Only War, and the only way to describe how like complex it is in comparison to Wrath and Glory is that there's 8 pages for your damage in the rule book. And it's like, oh, you hit them in the roll your dice arm with your plasma gun and roll your dice, their arm is blown off, and roll your dice and their leg now.
Yeah, there's definitely, there's a sort of, there's a style of games that are all really written for people who just want to read the book and roll and imagine rolling the dice. And then there's the type of game that's written for people who want to do the collaborative storytelling. And I think that's definitely the more fun games. Yeah. The ones that are rules light for me make much better games. And especially as a GM, it's odd to think the games that are rules light are easy to run, because you have that idea of, oh, but I need to know everything, I need to be in control of everything. But it's back to what you said earlier on, you know, about just being able to wing it, you know. So like ones like Genesis, where there's barely any dice, or I think you get different types of games. So your D100s, the ones that run off where all your skills are 100% and you try to roll under the number, those games tend to be a lot more freeform than your D20 style ones, like D&D, where you have a set number you've got to roll over. There's something about the freedom of the more realistic, so the sort of broader range of skill that lets you go, well, you know what, my character doesn't need to test to do this thing because it makes sense that they would just be able to do it. You know, like there's no need, oh, I'm playing as a doctor, I shouldn't need to make a first aid roll. Like, yeah. I am a doctor, so you just let your players away with that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, with the whole rules light thing, and talking of Dungeons & Dragons, in their most recent iteration, 5th edition, they have kind of brought in that there's a game for everybody with that, so you can still get right into the rules and all this nitty-gritty. They did also introduce the advantage and disadvantage system, where if you don't exactly know what to do, you can just go, cool, roll 2 dice and use the highest. Which, rules light just keeps things moving, and that is, I think, paramount in these kind of things, you know, just keeping the story going.
Because I've seen that in a number of the more recent games. They have these various mechanics that's all about, well, it didn't work, try again. So it's not like, oh, you've made the test and you failed it, so that's the end of the story. So like Call of Cthulhu has, you can either push the roll, which is you made a roll and you failed it, so you can push it. So you have a second go, and if you pass, you didn't quite pass as well as you were going to, and if you fail, it's even worse. Or you have luck you can spend to just change the number on your dice by the number of points you spend, that, you know, you can use the two systems independently to make the game work. Or things like in Wrath and Glory, you have that fail forward system of, even if you fail the check, you still do what you were trying to do, but there's a negative consequence, rather than just this, as a GM, what do you do? Like, you've put a locked door in your player's way and your players have failed to open the door. Is that just the end of the session? No, it's like a lot of modern games have ways of getting both you as a GM through that, but also giving your players something to do to get over the hurdle as well.
I also don't think a single time in any of the sessions I've ever run, a door has been a problem.
It's somebody, the old smash it down tactic.
Somebody always smashes it down.
Nice. Or in your game, sets it on fire.
That works though. Arson always works.
Please, this podcast does not the views respected in this podcast. Jesus. Can't even say it with a straight face.
For reference, all my roleplay games, doesn't matter what it is, I've set fire to something and it's always solved a problem. That's why this is funny to us. Yeah.
That's the astounding thing. It usually shouldn't, but
it always does.
RNG is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
See, it brings me back to when I played Cthulhu, and my first character that I'd ever played for Call of Cthulhu was a man with one arm who was an explosives expert. I solved every problem with an explosive, including giant lobsters, locked doors, people, mostly people, to be honest.
So, Mike, when I played Cthulhu, my character's problem-solving method was a little bit different. It started with alcohol, and then moved on to morphine, and then literally moved on to he existed on another... strange esoteric plane of existence where he could summon things into will because he didn't want to hang around in a world where demons were going to steal his soul.
Yeah, that's right. You gave up and went and just lived in the dream world, didn't you? You're like, no, I'm not coming back now. This is just where I am.
Made friends with a lot of cats.
Yeah. Which is great when you get a character arc like that. If you've been playing a campaign for a while and your character starts, you know, you've got your levels or whatever mechanic it is that your game uses, and you have this character who begins in one place and ends up very naturally through the game somewhere very different. Like that character you're talking about, was it Dr. Laurien?
Dr. Laurien, yeah.
And he starts from what was he was like, you
with
know, the little GP
child.
In France, yeah, with the wife and child, and everyone was kind of normal, and then he gets exposed to all the Cthulhu weirdness. And
it witnessed his best friend get minced by a clock.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, it was all just this sort of series of, well, you can see how he got there.
Yeah, this is understandable. Just bad. Yeah, and literally ending up on an alternate reality because it just seemed like a better choice. It was absolutely nuts.
Because you've had some in your Shadowrun campaign, some really interesting arcs for your characters, haven't you?
We've had somebody betray the party because they wanted out of this kind of life of crime. And it ended up with them being killed by the people that they were like trying to turn everybody into. We've had somebody be kidnapped, have to then watch their brother be taken over by spirits. And then the parties went to try and rescue them. And that's how we get to throwing toasters at dragons. Occasionally cats as well, actually.
What did they ever do to you?
Wasn't it a Hello Kitty toaster as well?
Yeah, so every time that you'd kind of like pressed it down, like the lever thing, it would meow.
Oh my god.
And they, you know...
Magic items. Some go for the band of intellect, some go for the flaming sword, some go for the meowing toaster.
Man, like, they made that to try and impress people at this big, like, conference that all these, like, big corporations would go to be like, oh, we're going to put money into this that will solve, like, poverty in this country. And they come in with this toaster.
That meows when you make a bagel.
Science has truly gone too far.
Because one of the things about being a GM is learning how to handle your players. Because your players, you have to, you know, you'll get the feel for when your players are going to stick to the script and when they're going to come up with their own madness and their own ideas and go off down a path. So how do you guys handle that in games that you're running when your players don't behave, as it were?
I'm laughing because sometimes things happen to them that aren't pleasant because of naughty behavior. So they'll like do something that they're very, very proud of, and they'll crit to pass it, and they'll pass it 100%. So they'll do that thing really, really well. But maybe the thing that they've just stolen might have like a giant pod behind it that just spews pus all over them. Just something like that. So like, it's just to kind of make them learn to be more cautious. And there's other silly, silly things that they do that just drives you wild when sometimes they like, because you sometimes see the glint in their eyes when they know they're doing the thing you don't want them to do. And then you're like, okay. And they go off on a massive tangent. I really don't mind them going on a tangent for ages because a lot of the time it'll be like a door that hasn't been written in is suddenly there and it'll suddenly transport them back to where they need to be just to make life easier because it lets them have their fun. And, you know, as long as they're having fun in the end, we can get to the end of the storyline eventually.
I'm just trying to think if I've had any particular issues with players. I mean, there was the whole losing a tangent thing when I first ran Pathfinder and the dwarf in the party, who I believe in his former life was a middle-aged grocer but wanted to pretend that he was a barbarian, so he just bought a big axe and left. This balding guy, he spent a very, very long time trying to find a way to get his hair back. You know, every occasion being, oh, does she sell any? No, this particular vendor does not sell hair growth potions. Till eventually I went, you know what? Oh, look, we found one. And as he was kind of sorting it out, putting on his character sheet, I just rolled a couple of dice behind my screen. And basically it was cursed. When he drank it, his hair grew back, luscious, long, voluminous, beard too. The second he stepped into sunlight, it all fell out. And it was just one of those... You know, you've spent the past 2-3 weeks constantly trying to get this thing, and hey, you got it.
Yeah, I've done that to people in Cthulhu as well. There's the famous you always get that type of player who's going to stick his finger into everything. Like, right, okay, so you found this, you know, puddle full of demonic goo. What do? You drink it. Okay, well, your eyes burn out your head. And then next week, oh, can I see again? Like, no, no, this persists. You have no eyes.
Eyes are gone, yeah. This seems to be a regular occurrence in these Cthulhu games. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Eyes melting out the face and then not coming back.
That and the hands that come free in the night and take your eyes.
Oh, I remember that. That's where we left it with us, wasn't it?
Dear. It's never conveniently fixed by like a cup of coffee and a quick nap. Is it?
No. The whole short rest thing, that's the other D&D one I love. Oh, I've been stabbed through the eyes and I've been set on fire by a dragon and I've jumped into some lava, but I've had a short rest, so I'm fine.
A coffee and a little biscuit and I feel so much better for it.
Well, there are kind of player-made like tables to solve that, where it's like if you have been crit, you roll on this table and there's like permanent effects that are like, oh, you got hit in the face with like a blunt weapon. Cool. You now have a broken nose and a broken jaw. That's going to take a while to fix. Mm-hmm. And here's like these negative effects because of it.
Some permanent issues for the damage they've taken.
Yeah,
it gives it that whole very real feel. Because, yeah, exactly. If you just go for that short rest and suddenly everything's hunky-dory, absolutely fine, even though you have just had a piano fall on your head. I don't know why there's strange piano levitating wizards around, but
why not?
They'll do what they want to do. I like the idea of having tables for that. It's actually a big thing with prep. So, you know, that's one thing I like to do. I'm very lazy. I like to prep very minimally, but it's because I like to homebrew stuff and I kind of know what's going on, so I can spitball it. But having tables, so I would always play with a botch table. So if players roll the worst result they can, I really like to make it bad. So then you roll on a little table. It could be they went to shoot somebody. The gun could explode. They could drop it. They could trip over. On a very, very, very bad occasion, a piano could fall out of the sky and hit them on the head. So I find having tables and charts, just because they're such a little thing that takes such a little time to prepare, and you can have a lot of fun and creativity with it, really good for minimal prep. I mean, do you guys have anything you'd like to do in terms of like, small prep like that?
The thing I was thinking about there, it's not really prep for me. It's a magic item that exists in D&D that I think is designed to teach GMs that you need to prep properly, and it's the deck of many things. And everybody, when they're playing D&D, will eventually go, this is really cool, I'm going to use the deck of many things in my game. And then they learn very quickly not to mess with that. Oh, I roll a D100 and the entire party's teleported onto the moon.
Yeah, that's the wonderful thing about the deck of many things. You know, you can be teleported to the moon, or you can wind up being the proud owner of a meowing Hello Kitty toaster. It's just so wild, and so, it makes for some funny moments, but you got to be careful.
That's definitely where it comes back to the GM. You're in control of your world, and you decide what's going to be allowable in it, and things like that are great. Like you say, the prep tables are really good if you come up with it in advance and you think, well, I'm going to have this, you know, and you'll have to do that prep once. You've made this prep table up of things that will happen if they roll badly, and you've got that forever. But when you bring in too much external randomness that you've given up control of, it just throws your games out the window.
Oh, completely, yeah. And not just out the window, out of your reach as well. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can claw that back.
No. There's an odd game that came out last year. I've only played it a couple of times, Overlight. And one of the mechanics of it is that if the player beats the GM in the dice roll, they get to take control of the story for a little while, which sounds really cool up until the point where you get someone who just like totally train wrecks what you were doing, and you've now got to scramble to put it all back together again. It's like, it's a really good idea. I think they've tried to do the whole let's involve the players and the GM as if they're all the same level, but it I think at the very top ends, it doesn't quite work mechanically.
I mean, I can see why it wouldn't work in such a way, but it's one of those situations that can be ironed out quite quickly by talking to your players before you start the game and setting some parameters. Mm-hmm. And just going, you know, you guys are going to be taking control. Don't be a dick about it, basically. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, everybody here is playing and having fun. If the story is building towards something, say it's building towards a grand journey over the sea, don't, when you get control, say the seas all bubble up and become toxic and you can't cross them there. Because nobody wins then. Nobody wins.
Although, having played and ran Overlight there are like a load of other ways for people to just throw things out the window. Mm-hmm. Like one of the spells that you can get from the very start of the game is basically Wish from D&D. But the only thing that it requires is that your player tells a short story, and it has to relate to the thing they want to do. Mm-hmm. And then depending on their level of success, it changes like, is it the amount of things they can do with it? But it's just this ability to go, yeah, I tell the short story and I can now fly. I bypass all these things you put down there.
Flying is one of those things in games where I spent ages one day drawing for a game of Palladium. It was years ago I did this. It's like a fantasy roleplay game. And I did this really complex maze in a forest, and it was full of encounters, and there was all this really cool stuff. And the party were having to go through this forest to get to the castle at the end, and the castle at the end was going to be the adventure the next week, and it was all set up. And I completely forgot that half the party had wings, and they just took one look at the forest and flew over the top of it.
Oh!
And you're like, oh.
Into the unprepped region. Yeah. That's one of those. I mean, I stand by, if they're going to pull that kind of nonsense as players, you can then pull some GM nonsense, go, oh, no, there is an enchantment on this. And you fall out the sky and land in the forest to deal with it. Because otherwise we're ending this 2 hours early.
Yeah. It was definitely one of those ones that I had to give them it and go, yeah, that's my fault. Like, you literally all have wings except one guy who can levitate.
Oh, God.
Fine.
With what you're saying about the wish thing and being able to influence the story, to draw back to it, Genesis has got a great system in place for that where you get story points. So at any point, I believe it's the players get a collected pool for each person. So if you've got four players, they get 4 points, and then the Games Master gets one. And what they can do is they can spend these points by giving them to the Games Master, who then has them to use himself, so they can change one detail. So the example from the book was you have landed on a toxic alien planet. And you get down to the hangar bay and go, oh no, we forgot to pack the spacesuits. You then just flip over story point and go, nope, don't worry, there are some in that locker over there. Everybody have a sigh of relief. Which is great because keeps it moving, but you then don't have the, and they all fly over the forest because that's not quite feasible with these things. So it gives them some control, but does go, remember,
you've now given that point to the
GM. Given that, and they can use that in turn. So if you want to pull more nonsense like that, they can go, oh, what was that? Sorry, there's a leak in your spacesuit. Oh, no.
Which is like, it's where the sort of formal tabletop games have started to bring in some of the more conversational party game mechanics. So it's like Baron Munchausen when you're playing
Baron Munchausen.
You know? And you all have the, oh, no, but really, is that what you said you did?
Are you sure?
Yeah. Yes. And then you have to try and... Because that's one, isn't it? When the player says something, if another player jumps in and says, no, I think you got that detail wrong, it wasn't that, it was this, and then you have to reformat the whole story around it.
So Baron Munchausen is a very odd one. There's a few like this, and I'm quite into them. They are completely games masterless games. So everybody sits and everybody's telling a story, but with Munchausen, you get given a prompt by the player to your left, and you're all role-playing as the wealthy and affluent... try that one again. Affluent... And you'll tell the story about how you met the Prince of the Moon. And people can weigh in and, you know, pass you a chip and go, you know, say, ah, yes, and I constructed my flying machine. And they'll go, oh, but my good sir. And they'll pass a chip towards you and they'll say, I remember you telling me just the other week, you are in fact afraid of heights, so of course you didn't fly. And you can then choose to take that and have an extra point and then change your story to fix that element or tell them no and not get the extra point. So finding a balance.
Well, that idea of the kind of story moments, that's really what you're playing these roleplay games for, I think, is it's for the collective story and it's for the group of people all telling some grand narrative that is unique specifically to these people. They're never, even if another set of players went through that game, they'd never run into that same combination of events again. So thinking of one there that I've had, which is really unique, is I have designed an intro adventure for Feng Shui that I like to do. If you've got a couple hours and no one's played Feng Shui before, it's really good for getting people into it, really straightforward. A guy dies in a car park. Why does everyone know this guy? why did he die? And that's it. But it always ends up in this factory where someone's making drugs, and they're making drugs out of magic animals from a different universe, but that's okay because it's feng shui. And if you've never played the game before, it's all based on every action movie and every martial arts movie you've ever seen is all real and happening at the same time. And that's the plot of the game. So like Big Trouble in Little China meets Die Hard meets Mad Max all at once, with time travel and occasional dinosaurs. It's just nonsense.
And noodle whipping bodyguards,
things like that.
Yeah.
So I've played this adventure loads and loads and loads of times, and I've refined it over and over because I think it's a really good way of introducing people to the game until we ran it with you guys.
Yeah.
And then we get to the vat of drugs and you're fighting the monster at the end and you went through yourself in it.
Yep, I figured that was the best method. It was, so this vat of drugs, I saw it turn somebody into this strange were-animal creature. And so within the group, we had like a psychic detective, a martial arts cop, like a renegade cop, I think you were, Louise.
Yeah, like if I said like a one-liner before I shot my gun, I got bonus shots.
And
yeah.
I was just playing like a Kurt Russell all-American dude who liked to drink beer. And I was sort of like, what the hell am I going to do here? And just threw myself in.
And emerged as the American Eagle.
The American Eagle. I turned into an eagle man, channeling the spirit of the great US of A.
But I just thought, like, how many times have I played that adventure and no one had ever thought the giant poisonous fat that turns people into weird half creatures, I'll just drink it.
I had nothing else going for me. It was either death or glory. Unfortunately, it was glory.
It was funny.
You got any things like that stick out for you?
In Pathfinder, I once got stuck in a pile of corpses for an entire session, just not being able to get out and almost drowning in them. I tried climbing up this chute. I failed that everybody else had managed to. And I just kind of lost my grip, fell in for 2 hours. And I loved every second of it. Like, everybody else is going off on this adventure to try and reclaim their memories and their, like, weapons and armor. And I'm here not knowing who I am, why I'm naked, and why I'm in a pile of corpses.
Sounds like a Sunday morning to me.
Okay. Pass the toast. You got anything like that, Louise?
I think my current favorite thing isn't like an elaborate story or anything, but it's like how we're doing Hidden Sun, and everyone's got really complicated like storylines going on. Like somebody's got to find out what's happening with like some angels and why a deity's gone, and somebody else has got like a mystery to solve, and then someone else has got to find their mentor, and everyone's got really elaborate storylines, and because of the way the game builds, and you like, you don't know what you're getting until you get there, and everyone's got these amazing storylines, and then the only thing my character has right now, you're laughing, is that I've got a sad seashell that wants to go home, and that's it. That's my story, my entire character's plot point right now, and I just love that because it's just so funny.
It's
compared
like,
to everyone else's.
What is this going to be? Like, I'm convinced it's going to end up so important. This seashell has some amazing destiny and it wants to achieve it. And it's just like, yeah, okay, everyone else is trying to save the world, but no, Louise, the seashell's important. But I was just, while we're talking about this, then I was thinking about the one, I think some of you were in the game when this one happened with Back to Cthulhu, where Danny got stuck in the bin.
Yes.
Oh. God.
So, you've got a character who is on a fire escape and he's trying to run away from some bad guys, and he slips off the fire escape, falls off the edge, but he lands in a skip, right? And he's at the back of an opera house in Italy. So the opera is on and he's shouting for help and no one can hear him because it's noisy, right? And there's a thunderstorm going on and he's in this bin. So he's trying to climb out the skip, but he'd taken so much damage on the fall that he had broken his arm, so he couldn't climb out the skip. So, and the skip was full of broken rubbish, so he did himself even more damage trying to get out. But he had access to magic, which in Cthulhu is not ever a good thing, right? So you have no all-powerful wizards in Cthulhu. You have done something stupid, learned an ability, and every time you use it, the world will get very slightly worse for everyone round about you. So first off, he tried to use a spell to levitate himself out of it, messed up the casting, and instead of it raining on him, it was now raining blood down on him. So he's lying in this bin with his broken arm, summoning blood clouds to rain on him. The second thing he tried to do was use a sort of telekinesis power to like push the bin over, and all he did was manage to pull all the rubbish in the bin down on himself harder. And eventually he got so annoyed that he used this blood ritual that he had discovered in a book, summoned a minor demon to appear, drag him out of the bin, which it did, but then he lost control of it, so it just ran amok in the theatre, murdering most of the people in Venice. That's great, just to get out of a bin.
Didn't it, like, take him in the bin on top of, like, a tower, and then it's like, well, you could have put me somewhere more useful.
Yeah, because he said, get me out of here, but he didn't say where, so it just picked him up and left him on a roof and then went away.
Oh, dear.
So that's all the fun. Like, definitely when you're the GM and you go, oh, I'm just gonna push this one, just see how far we can get. Oh, the lion. Yeah. Oh, that was a brilliant one. We had a character who in a D&D party who had been a warlock and wasn't a very good one. Like, and that was fine. He'd made his character up and he wasn't really enjoying playing it. And his warlock was okay, but it wasn't brilliant, but it was okay. And then we were going through this game and he got cursed and turned into a lion. So when we decided that he would play the rest of the adventure using the stats for the lion, which were so much better than his stats for a human warlock. So just being a lion was better than this. And he'd went through so long playing as the lion that we had decided that he had begun to, like, his willpower had begun to reassert itself. And since he was only very low level at the time anyway, he only had access to a couple of spells. So the lion was then able to cast, if it got extreme successes, he was able to cast minor magic. So the lion could eventually, I think he could shoot fireballs and he could levitate when he roared.
Goodness.
And that was what it was. And then this went on for several adventures to the point where, you know, they met gods and bigger wizards and things like that who would say, no, we'll turn you back into a human. And he just refused because his character arc had been like, no, he just, like, he'd never lived until he was this lion. And then he became this heroic lion, and this was his thing now, and he just played the rest of that character's life out as the flying lion. The flying lion.
Oh, that was a very fun campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the whole thing when it comes to being the GM is it's not about knowing everything. It's about do you know enough to be able to react to what's happening, and do you know enough to make it fun for the people who are playing the game with? So it's that. Not writing a story or writing an adventure for you as the GM. You remember, you're writing it for your players. So you set the sandbox up for your players, and then as long as they get to do what they want to do within the rules of that, then that kind of makes it fun for everybody. Because it's really not... I think people look at it being the dungeon master and they go, oh, or the games master, and go, oh, that must be so difficult, it's so much work. And it's like, it's not really, it is maybe once, the first time you do it, you go, okay, you might have to prep your tables, you'd have to think about the story or something like that. But after you've done that, you really just get to sit back a lot of the time and let the players.
Oh, it's astounding the amount of just shutting up you do. Yeah, I've sat for a session and only really said like 3 or 4 sentences.
Mm-hmm.
it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I ever GM'd, I almost killed my whole party. Because I just made a mistake and everyone almost died.
That was all you'd...
Will-o'-the-wisps.
Yeah, that was it. It's like, this looks like a cute bad guy. I'll have him fight that. No, it's actually really up on level.
Yeah, 5 of them.
Army of them.
Yeah. Yep.
Ooh. So, yeah.
But everyone was fine and it was a good time.
The whole GM sandbox is probably one of the best ways to describe it. Because one of the easy traps to fall into is you see it and you say, oh, you've got to write a campaign. And people think of it as like writing a book, writing a story. But the thing is, you're not in control of the main characters. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can set it up and be sort of, yes, the grand wizard Steve, not feeling particularly creative today, has set up in Gloomhold Castle, much better. And is planning to raise the undead to march out and turn the world into ash and bones. The players will go along and they'll encounter these people and these people, and no, they're probably going to go off and find a donkey they like the look of and piss about for a bit. But if you've got a sandbox in place, you can, and you know how the world works and how things work and how your players want to work, perhaps that donkey they really like could become a thing. You could have a way of the donkey has escaped from a caravan of brigands and bandits who recently took a bunch of slaves from a township who were under the command of the Grand Wizard Steve. So boom, there we go. The donkey leads them back. They run into that. They get the plot hook. So if you've just got all these bits, you can just smash them together and find a way to turn your players the right way without railroading them.
It's like you said earlier on, Louise, about having bullet points rather than the whole story written. Yeah. So you just have, these are things that are going to happen, but how they happen is up to the players, and the order they happen in is the order they encounter them. They don't need to, it doesn't need to be so prescribed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like your analogy of the magic door, like, oh, you found this door and it puts you back to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Everyone has fun in between.
Café du plot.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Well, thanks very much for that. I think that's enough for today. So for our first ever podcast, I hope that entertained some folk and we got some people thinking about what it's like to GM different games. So thanks to everybody.